Whose responsibility is it to drive sustainability in the built environment? Is it legislators, investors, contractors, or consumers? To answer this question, I'm joined by four of UCEM's academic team. Arguing on behalf of legislators is our CERT-HE programme leader and expert in environmental law, Hazel Lobo. Bagging the drum for investors is our real estate programme leader and property investment expert, David Hourihan. Vouching for contractors is our building surveying programme leader and sustainability expert, James Ritson. And flying the flag for consumers is our tutor and economics expert, Janet Hontoir. Each academic has 3 minutes to put forward their case. I will hit the bell when that time has elapsed. There will then be an opportunity for their peers to ask one question each with answers lasting a maximum of 1 minute. Again, the bell dictating when time is up. After each argument and Q&A, I'll give everyone 30 seconds to provide a closing statement, at which point the podcast will end, and then it is over to you, our listeners, to decide who made the most compelling case by voting in our poll. So let's get going. Hazel, you have 3 minutes to argue in favour of the statement, legislators hold the most responsibility in driving sustainability in the built environment. With your time, starting now.
Thank you. COP26 has focused the minds of the world on climate change, one aspect of sustainability that desperately needs addressing. Many of us will remember for a long time the description of almost Armageddon-like impacts presented by the President of the Maldives, experiences echoed by other leaders. However, COP26 also showed us the danger of relying on goodwill and common sense to make meaningful change. That's why I'm arguing that legislators should hold the most responsibility for driving sustainability in the built environment. Some of you will have noticed that I said should hold rather than hold, and also most responsibility, and we'll come back to both of those points. Let's start by remembering that sustainable development is not a new concept. Long before Brundtland presented the seminal definition or the UN developed the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, sustainability was a feature of life. Those who study our past present the evidence that our distant forebears lived in sustainable communities, using raw materials available to them, making full use of those resources, and living in harmony with nature for the most part. Those long-gone occupants of our planets lived in close-knit communities, overseen by elders. And those elders were the law. They made the rules. The communities followed those rules, making things better for everyone. One of the key messages from COP26 is that too many of us no longer live in harmony with the planet. The things we do here affect our fellow occupants across the world who cannot take action against us. We are having global impacts, and global impacts require global solutions. Only legislation can effect this. Voluntary agreements are easily ignored. Look at all the agreements made in previous COPs, and therein lies the flaw in my argument. Yes, legislation can create a common playing field. It can mandate action or prohibit it on a whole population, whether that's local, national, or international. But that action or prohibition is only effective if it is complied with. Legislation should be driving sustainability, but it needs to be followed, which is where the most responsibility bit comes in. What we really need is legislation that is acted upon, legislation that is supported by those governed by it. Legislators may hold the most responsibility, but we must each of us play our part. Investors, contractors, and consumers are all, at the end of the day, citizens. Individually or in those smaller collectives, we can each make a small and important change. But only under the mandate of well-written and effectively enforced legislation can we make the whole-scale difference required to save our planet.
Almost perfect there.
I haven't said thank you.
So that was the 3 minutes and Hazel's argument there. Very well timed. And now it's question time and we go to our other panellists to ask one question each. So first up, David.
Just in terms of legislation change, what is the most pressing challenge preventing change, would you say, Hazel?
Cohesion. Getting people to actually agree on what's needed and therefore what we can actually do. People have too many different viewpoints. It just makes it so hard to get anything that works for everybody. We need to look at working for the planet rather than looking for working for people.
Thank you, Hazel. James?
How would you deal with the situation that America found itself in where Trump withdrawn himself from the agreements? And again, we see this across the world where there is an economic disparity between climate, gender and short-term economic benefit. How would you legislate against those with a change in political power?
That's a really great question, James, and probably far too far reaching for 1 minute. So forgive me for a really simple answer. We need to deal with it on a global level. The world needs to hold leaders to account. We need to have something in place that gives the UN teeth so that when one leader, whether it's the leader of arguably the most powerful nation in the world, or whether it's the leader of an economically powerful nation like China, or Russia for that point, we need to have an overseeing body who has the teeth to say, no, you must do this. And that's where legislation has to come in. Voluntary agreements just won't cut it. Time and time again, world leaders say, yeah, the rest of you do that, I'm going to do this.
Fantastic. Well under the 1 minute. And Janet, do you have a question?
Yes, Hazel. Can I ask you, do you think that the British example of flammable cladding is an example which shows us that actually laws follow consumer needs and they don't precede them?
It's another great question, Janet. Thank you. Firstly, I do not hold up the British as an example of anything good in this respect. We have absolutely as many things that we do poorly as any other nation. Flammable cladding's a great point. We did have legislation in place that should have prevented that from happening. Unfortunately, it wasn't followed. And that's where the enforcement element comes in. We need legislation that has real teeth. We need everybody to get behind legislation and, as you said, to push things. But if we don't have the legislation in place in the first place, then there isn't going to be anything that people can do. The finances will always hold sway.
Thank you, Hazel. So next, we turn to David, who is arguing in favour of the statement, investors hold the most responsibility in driving sustainability in the built environment. With your time, starting now.
Andrew, thank you very much. I'm not too sure I'm going to actually need 3 minutes because I think the responsibility that landlords hold is quite simple. Landlords respond to the economics of the environment. The profit is something that all landlords relate to. Popular pressure has grown to such an extent, and was very evident during COP26 there recently. Popular pressure in the form of wanting change for the global economies to decarbonize. Landlords are well aware of that now, and they can no longer ignore it. One must remember, if we take the UK just as an example, within the UK, and this is a 2017 figure, so it's a little bit dated, the actual value of stock, real estate stock, residential, commercial, all stock, was 8.8 trillion. And you know, the largest landlords owning that property, that stock, are institutional type investors. They have already in place very strong environmental, social, governance standards, which is great to see. I think one thing that has been an issue for landlords is clear evidence that moving to better standards of sustainability in their buildings, they couldn't put a clear monetary value to that. That has now changed. There's clear evidence. There's a widening gap between the term green rental premium and brown rental discount buildings that are going out of date, nobody wants. And actually, lockdown has sped up that process, where now tenants who respond to consumer habits and behaviours, i.e. the popular pressure, they will only take space that has up-to-the-minute green credentials, strong sustainability technologies and so on. Landlords know that. If they don't react to that, they're in trouble. As Mark Carney, the former Bank of England governor, recently declared, people want climate change dealt with. They've heard enough talk. He further added that you're going to have to come up with a plan to decarbonize as a landlord, or you're going to have to wind down your business. It's as simple as that. So I'll leave it there, Andrea. I think that's all I need to say about it. Landlords have a responsibility.
17 seconds remaining. So there we go. Well done, David. And question time now. So, James.
Thank you, David. You mentioned landlords, David. What about the other investors, the corporate investors who invest, such as pension funds and so forth, in that? How do you think they should be responding to this investment criteria for sustainability?
Yeah, thanks, James. Institutional type investors already, such as the pension funds, have, like their landlords, have very strong standards. The people whose monies they look after in the pensions also want to have pensions that are investing ethically and in a sustainable manner. So in effect, the pension contributors are stakeholders in the pensions. When those stakeholders are telling the pension funds what they want, the pension funds are responding in like manner. That is then feeding into where they place what they will buy, and either directly or indirectly in real estate. Everything is being driven by popular pressure now. And it was really interesting, COP26, just to see how evident that was, and seeing
leaders. Sorry, David. I'm sorry.
Expressing that. Thank you, James.
Yep. So that was the minute. So I had to intervene. These are the rules of the game. Next question coming from Janet.
Yes, thank you, Andrew. David, some investors put their money into high-risk junk bonds. How can we prevent a similar parallel case from happening in the property investment market?
Yeah, there is a broad range of investor types. Some will look for greater risk returns in a more speculative short-term manner. That is, as opposed to long-term risk-averse type investors, you will never change the market in that respect. Human nature being what it is, there are some people who just want to speculate. That is not necessarily a bad thing. I think, though, as greater awareness about what needs to happen in terms of change feeds into the subconscious of everyone concerned, even speculative investors will improve their standards in terms of what they want from an investment. In terms of return, making a quick buck out of investment, they will factor in allowances for better standards. And I think also they are responding to the marketplace as
Sorry,
well.
David. So. Sorry, David. That's your minute.
You.
So final question coming from Hazel.
Thanks, David. You made some really great points there, and you've tackled some difficult questions already, but here's another one, I'm afraid. Great that you identified that the best practice within the industry, where profit is driving change, but very often profit prohibits improvement, because we're told that laws, for example, can't be implemented because it would lead to economic hardship. So how do we make profit a real incentive to improving sustainable development rather than it being a barrier?
I think, again, it goes back to how the profit is being made. If it's being made in an ethical, sustainable manner, nobody has a problem with that. The real obvious difference now is the damage it can have on the reputation of a business if they're found to be producing buildings that are substandard in terms of standards, sustainable standards. Again, to quote Mark Carney, just you might as well wind down your business. It's that damaging. It's become that big an issue for the wider public, the wider markets. So you have to get on board with adopting better standards if you want to make any profit at all. It's as simple as that.
Great stuff. 13 seconds remaining. So we've now heard from Hazel and David. And yeah, thank you for your comments and your arguments, Dave, there, David. Third up, we have James, who's arguing in favour of the statement, contractors hold the most responsibility in driving sustainability in the built environment. With your time, starting now.
Thank you, Andrew, for your introduction. Yeah, of course, contractors have the most responsibility. We are the professionals that actually build the built environment. We are the designers and the architects. We are the constructors, the building professionals who actually build the built environment. And we are the ones who maintain it. And I think that's what is so key about this statement. We are the ones that actually create the built environment. Yes, the investors will fund it. Yes, the consumer will purchase and use it. And we will always, as responsible constructors, sit within the legislation. But in the end, it is us that actually builds and constructs our built environment. And therefore, it is we have the most responsibility. That is why, as a university, we teach directly sustainability throughout all of our modules. This is why in this country, we virtually now build to zero carbon standards within the built environment. This is why we design and build our built environment to be sustainable. And therefore, we should be the leaders and the most responsible for creating that sustainable future. Now, along with building it, we have to maintain and adapt it. And as Hazel has touched upon, and so has David, we have focused increasingly on climate change, but there are several, many other factors that go in to driving a sustainable built environment. These are laid out in the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and we are the ones that need to be able to deliver that. We are the professionals who are on the ground driving that forward. We need to innovate, adapt, and alter to the changing scenarios that sustainability will draw up, be them climate change, energy efficiency, reducing emissions, water usage, and waste. We need to be the ones that take the lead, and therefore we need to hold the most responsibility, because we are the professionals who are at the coalface building the actual built environment. We have a responsibility to deliver throughout the life cycle of the building a well-designed, well-built, and well-maintained built environment for us all, because sustainability is about creating a better future for us all. And that's why the contractors hold the most responsibility, because we are the professionals that actually deliver that. Thank you very much.
With 10 seconds remaining, well done. So, question time, Janet.
Thank you, Andrew. James, I would like to ask you, please, it's well known that there is a huge amount of waste created on building sites, and much of it goes straight into landfill. Why are contractors not doing something about this?
It's an economic imperative. If it is cheaper for them to dispose of that material than it is for the time it takes to recycle it, then they will do that. And that's what the importance outside of this is, developing a circular economy in the way that we see the benefits of recycling and therefore. And in fact, when we say there is huge amounts of waste in the contracting, that's in this country. If you take an area, for example, China or India, where materials are expensive, but human time and contractual time is cheap, you actually see a reduced wastage in materials. So what we need to do is to build a circular economy where the imperative is on the material, not just on the manpower, person power within the construction.
Great stuff. Can we have a question now from Hazel?
Absolutely. Well done, James. Really good points. Again, picking up on this idea that contractors create the built environment, of course they do. And with Janet's earlier point about cladding and the dangers of flammable cladding in mind, and your specific comment that contractors need to take the lead rather than do take the lead. How do we ensure that globally, since it's a global problem that needs global solutions, all contractors are actually creating that best outcome that you talked about, creating that best built environment?
They need to have that professional standards within them. And this is what where we need it. We talk about recyclability and we talk about the five R's of reduce, recycle. Actually, the three I's are more important: integration, infrastructure, and institutional quality. And that institutional quality comes from our building professionals. That's why places like the RICS, the CIOB are so important. They have professional standards and professional ethics that they should uphold. And unfortunately, some people, as David pointed out, there will be people who will try to break the rules. And those need to be resolved. It is not professionally ethically to build something that is harmful to the present. The definition of sustainability is meeting the needs of today without endangering the needs of tomorrow. And making a building a health hazard is not meeting the needs of today.
Thank you, James. And final question coming from David.
This is kind of building a little bit on what Hazel, I was thinking in similar terms to Hazel, in terms of the global, how do we ensure consistency in standards globally? And so my kind of follow on to that is, do we need to have an overriding entity with teeth to ensure standards? What would James's thoughts be on that for contractors?
The idea that you could get out of countries like the EU, China and America to all agree to be overpowered by their local courts, by an overarching authority, above them, I think is at the moment certainly unlikely. I think what we do need is we need to have some key overall objectives: low carbon, low waste, low water consumption, energy efficiency. As energy efficiency needs to be the driver. They need to be legislated at a local level, but they need to be agreed at an international level. And the contractors, as part of their professional ethics, should be, as building professionals, CIOB, RICS, and the international ones, should be meeting those standards. So I think that it is all very well saying it's the legislation and we just meet the legislation. You have a professional responsibility.
Sorry, James.
To meet that.
The dinger has finally got you. It was almost a clean sweep. But thank you for your arguments and your answers to the three questions. And finally, we have Janet, who is arguing in favour of the statement, consumers hold the most responsibility in driving sustainability in the built environment. With your time, starting now.
Thank you, Andrew. Well, contractors want higher market share, higher revenues, and of course, higher profits. And this means that they need to persuade consumers to buy or rent their buildings and governments to accept their bids. So because consumers are the people at the end of the product line who vote with their bank accounts, it's they who are the ones who drive sustainability. If consumers reject products which are not sustainable, then contractors will be forced to modify their inputs and their practices, and investors will be forced to finance only those which do this. So to take housing as an example, purchasers must insist that the properties they buy are built with low carbon materials, have up-to-date insulation and ventilation systems, and clean and efficient energy. If not, they won't buy them. Consumers are now very aware of sustainability issues, and they provide firms with feedback on their products. This is easier than ever in the days of social media, as many firms actively seek their opinions as part of their public relations and marketing policies. Consumers are also included in the focus groups, which advise on large infrastructure projects like HS2. So consumers have the opportunity to let contractors know their wants and preferences, and it's a short-sighted firm which doesn't design its products around these. And of course, consumers are also voters, and they can put their cross beside the name of the national or local candidate who promotes sustainability and a sustainable built environment. Lastly, consumers don't just buy or rent buildings, but they live and work in them too. A high percentage of carbon emissions comes from buildings, and so consumers are responsible for using them sustainably, for example, by setting their thermostats lower and by not tearing up their gardens in order to make parking room for their cars. Besides, we all consume buildings. Governments inhabit parliament and ministerial buildings. Companies are situated in commercial complexes. And society as a whole uses public infrastructure. We are all consumers, and as such, we are the ultimate judges who set the agenda. Consumers are the ones who are responsible for driving sustainability.
Fantastic. So the concisest answer yet, 27 seconds remaining there. And now we move on to our questions. So first up, Hazel.
Thanks, Janet. Consumers have great power, absolutely. They are absolutely responsible for driving things. Unfortunately, at the moment, that tends to be driving need, driving our disposable economy, driving our almost insatiable demand for a better phone, a better television, a better whatever, more holidays abroad. How do we get consumers behind the need to save the planet on a scale, a Greta Thunberg scale almost, but globally?
Yes, Hazel, it's a major point. Consumers don't always use the power or the latent power that they have available. It's often believed that when people have to change their behaviour, we need to change their attitudes first. I believe the opposite. I believe we have to change people's behaviour, and that's by setting an example, and we all set examples for each other, and that change in behaviour will then change attitudes, so that increasingly more and more people are brought on board and are seeing sustainable practices as the norm and not as the exception.
Thank you, Janet. Next up, David.
Janet, thank you for your piece on consumers. People from around the world all have different driving ambitions, I guess you could term it in that way. What is the greatest barrier, do you think, to consumer power being, you mentioned it was latent. What's the biggest barrier to harnessing it, would you say, currently?
Yes, David, I think, you know, following on from what I said in answer to Hazel's question, it's a change in culture, and that would be different in different countries. But I also believe that as climate change makes itself more and more felt, and we see all the negative results of what we've created, I think that consumers will come on board more and start to use the power that they do have to insist that enough is enough, and that we have to reduce our emissions and make us our practices more sustainable. And if this is something which is passed around the world, let's say, through social media particularly, then I think it will catch on.
Okay, and our final question coming from James.
Thank you, Janet. How do you persuade people to become sustainable when they have more overarching issues such as homelessness, the lack of homes, and other, shall we say, sustainable issues in their minds? How do you get them to choose sustainable buildings?
Yes, that's a very good point. And of course, people look at their budgets, first of all. And I think that, I won't say in the long term, but I think in the medium term, at least, more sustainable products will become cheaper eventually, so that sustainable energy will come on board in a much bigger way and hopefully become cheaper than fossil fuel energy is at the moment, so that there isn't a choice for people. In the meantime, I do think it's a big barrier. And again, it's a matter of choice, and perhaps, you know, there are certain things that people buy that are not necessary, and maybe their preferences and their perceived needs will change as the culture grows more towards sustainability. But I don't think this is a reason for saying that it is not consumers that drives sustainability. I think it's just that there are clearly barriers, as there are with each of the stakeholders we've looked at today.
Just in time. So yeah, thank you, Janet. And we've heard all of the arguments, all of the questions and answers as well. And to close this debate, I would now ask you to provide your closing statements. You have 30 seconds each. And first, we have Hazel.
We can't legislate for consumer behaviour change, Janet, not without becoming a dictatorship. Nonetheless, Legislation is what creates those standards that many of you have spoken so eloquently about. We must put effective, enforceable legislation at the heart of all that we do so that consumers are armed with rights they can enforce, contractors are empowered, and landlords and investors are supported to move more widely in adopting ethical procedures and practices.
Just within the time, thank you very much, Hazel. 30 seconds now is with David.
Thank you, Andrew. I'd just like to summarise that, to make the point that I have a lot of hope for the future in terms of the responsibilities that our landlords and investors have in the marketplace. If we think back, I know it's a movie, Wall Street, 1987, Gordon Gekko, the stock trader, he epitomised all that was wrong with the system. He used that expression, greed is good. Nowadays, everyone is using the expression, green is good. I live in hope. Thank you.
There we go. Just about. And 30 seconds now for James.
Thank you, Andrew. In the end, legislators, consumers, investors need to have sustainable buildings built. And that is the job of the contractors. They need to be able to design and build sustainable buildings, cities for us to be able to live in. Therefore, they have the most responsibility. They need to be able to design and build cities that will have and enforce our sustainable future. Thank you.
Very good. And finally, Janet, you now have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Andrew. If consumers don't demand a sustainable built environment, then governments will not pass green laws because they're not vote winners. Investors will not channel funding into green building projects because the returns will be too low, and contractors will not build sustainably because nobody demands it. If consumers don't take responsibility, there is no incentive for any other group to act sustainably.
And there we go. Once again, within the time frame, that is it for all of your arguments. Thank you very much to Hazel, to David, to James, and to Janet. And now it's over to you, our listeners. Having heard all of the arguments, who do you think holds the most responsibility for driving sustainability in the built environment? Please head to our webpage to vote now, and we look forward to sharing the results. Thanks for listening.